Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with Jeffrey Goldberg. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He was for 10 years a Middle East correspondent, both for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. He's winner of the National Magazine Award for his reporting on Hezbollah. He's also a former columnist for the Jerusalem Post and The Forward. Right now, he makes his home in Washington, D.C. But back in 1990, he was living in Israel. He had made the decision to move to Israel. He joined the army and found himself assigned to be a guard at a prison, a jail, that was holding Palestinian militants. And at that time, he decided that it would probably be a good idea to try to get to know some of these men, get to know what they thought, and did indeed strike up a relationship with one man, a man named Rafik, a relationship that continues to this day, and a relationship that he writes about in his book, Prisoners, A Muslim and Jew Across the Middle East Divide. That's the subtitle. The book is published by Knopf, and it came out last fall. And he's joining us this morning to talk about that, and also perhaps to talk about the continuing divide between Muslims and Jews. It is our pleasure to have him here on the program. And of course, for people who are listening here this morning, there's always a possibility to call in and join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments. And we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and try to keep things moving along. But of course, people who are listening, they're welcome to participate. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and calls on us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, calls certainly are welcome. Mr. Goldberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just again, to give the basic setup here to tell the story, as you do in the book, maybe you might talk a little bit about how it is and why it is that you decided to move to Israel.
Oh, you want to go all the way back? Okay.
Well, just at least to kind of start.
Well, it's not a normal thing to do for someone from Long Island. And I was coming out of the University of Pennsylvania when I decided to do this. I was raised in a tradition support for Israel. I mean, I'm going to oversimplify it just to get through the story quickly.
Sure.
And I decided early on in my life that I wanted to be in the Israeli army. I had fallen in love with the idea of the Israeli soldier, if you will, the raid on Entebbe, the Six-Day War. It was, you know, evidence of Jewish power or Jewish muscle that I had not seen in my own life, and in fact, quite the opposite. I grew up in a place where there were no Jews, but there were anti-Semites. What we lacked for Jews, we made up for an anti-Semite. And as a kid, I had, you know, some experiences, schoolyard experiences with that sort of violence. And so it seemed like one answer personally for me. And then, you know, as I got older, I decided that this was a responsibility that I had. I thought that Jews should go help the Jewish state. And also, look, I was a 20-year-old, and I, you know, wanted some action, and the Middle East is a good place to have some action.
Okay, so then in 1990, you joined the Israeli Defense Forces, but the assignment that you ended up with wasn't exactly what you had imagined.
No, I was not a commando raiding Entebbe. I was sent to a prison camp in the Negev Desert. It was the largest prison we had during the first Palestinian uprising. If you recall, the Israeli army, the Israeli government decided to deal with the uprising by arresting as many people as possible. They thought that they could put down a popular uprising by just arresting it. It's an impossibility, of course, but it took a while to learn that. In the meantime, we had this prison in the desert, and the day I got there, there were 6,200 prisoners in this place. So it was quite a massive facility.
So there were 6,200 prisoners. How many Israeli soldiers were
probably
there?
Around 300 or so at any given moment, you know, just sort of keeping watch over the place. Not a lot. I mean, obviously we had, you know, we were outside the fence and they were in, and we had the guns and they didn't. But, you know, it was still a kind of a very tense place that frequently erupted into violence.
What the Palestinians who were there, who you were guarding, what had they done?
Oh, this was everybody. This was everyone from the 16-year-old rock thrower, you know, who threw a rock or a Molotov cocktail at a Jeep, to the leaders of the uprising, and even the one of my prisoners, who I got to know much better later on, was a fellow named Abdelaziz Rantisi, who was one of the founders of Hamas. So we had everybody from the foot soldiers all the way up to the pinnacle of the leadership of the uprising.
So what was it that that made you decide, and this would have been an attitude that would not have been shared probably with almost all of the other guards, the people that you worked with, made you decide that it might be a good idea to try at least to talk with the prisoners, to get to know them, to know something about them?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I'm a nosy person. That's why I went into journalism. I like to ask questions. So there was that. I mean, I found myself realizing that I was in an extraordinary place. This was a closed military zone. Writers, reporters couldn't get in, but here I was, you know, and I was in, I guess you would say, a cub reporter at the time, or incipient reporter, or something. So I thought, wow, you know, this is a pretty amazing place. And I knew enough to know then that the people we were guarding would one day be the leaders of Palestine. I mean, I saw even then the inevitability of the formation of a state of Palestine, so I thought these were interesting people. There was a deeper reason, and this is not to, you know, I wouldn't cast aspersions on my fellow guards and military policemen. Most people went with the idea of just getting out alive, and we weren't really allowed to have the kind of contact with the prisoners that I had. But I decided that I was going to talk to them as much as possible to find out about them, and not only for the nosiness, as I said, but because I really believed in a kind of juvenile way, grandiose way, I guess, that maybe, you know, in this small corner of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, maybe it's possible to actually have a conversation, a quiet conversation with people who to try hard to locate in them their humanity and allow them to see perhaps my humanity. I had a very American idea about the power of reconciliation and the power of dialogue, and so I thought, you know, why not give it a go?
And just to make sure people understand this, what you were doing, your attempt to try to talk with prisoners and this relationship you struck up with one in particular, you were actually not supposed to be doing that.
No, I mean, look, I had a job in which I was in direct contact with the prisoners all day long. I was meant to deal with their food needs and health needs and security needs and all this sort of thing. But we're not supposed to talk about politics and God forbid, religion, you know. That's not a recipe for happiness in a Middle Eastern prison. I would get into trouble sometimes for chatting too much, being too much of a chatty Cathy, I guess you would say, with these guys. But I was fascinated. You know, I really was. I had not ever really met a Palestinian before I got to this place. Yet they loomed large in my mind, obviously, as someone who was devoted to Israel. We didn't have Palestinians on Long Island in New York when I was growing up. So it was this marvelous opportunity to get to know these very, very foreign people with whom my fate was entwined.
And your fellow guards there, obviously, they seemed to think you were either soft-headed or soft-hearted or both, or just crazy even for making the attempt.
Yeah, I mean, in varying degrees, some people just thought, a lot was excused because I was American, and they just assumed that Americans are dumb in a kind of way. In the following sense, the Middle East is a harder place than America, and the assumption was that you come into this place with your American ideas, and you're bound to become disappointed. So a lot of it was just sort of that. Yeah, there was this feeling that it's a bit muddle-headed to think that you can actually have a conversation with some of these guys. And by the way, that feeling existed on the Palestinian side as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not as if all these Palestinians were so willing and happy to engage in a dialogue about the political situation with a Jewish guard. You know, it's not what It's not what was on their minds either.
Well, it seems pretty clear that the way that most people on both sides thought was going on was that, in fact, it was a war and that the other side was the enemy and there was really no point in even trying to talk to the enemy.
Right. Well, we were in a very difficult time. Much of this was during the first Gulf War, the Iraq War, round one. So feelings were very, very hard. Remember, Israel was being bombed by Saddam Hussein during much of this period. So there were very hard feelings on my side, and there were very hard feelings on the Palestinian side. And this, of course, is also before the peace process began. This is before the Oslo peace process. So there was no, I mean, it sounds funny, but this is one of the few places on earth, this prison camp, one of the few places on earth where Palestinians and Israelis were actually talking to each other at all.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jeffrey Goldberg. Just a quick introduction again, reintroduction. He's a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He's also worked for The New York Times Magazine. Has done a lot of writing about the Middle East. And his book, his memoir, which has just now been out a couple of months, was published last fall, is Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. It's published by Knopf. A more full and complete telling of the story that we are sketching out here. Questions, comments, too. Welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So how is it that in particular one man caught your attention and you started talking with him and struck up something of a relationship with him?
Yeah, you're talking about this fellow Rafiq. Well, it's a great question because I've thought about that myself. He was different than a lot of people there. He wasn't quite so hostile for one thing. He was funny. He had a sense of humor, which is not something that you find, you know, Middle East prisons, not generally a great source of humor. And he had this ironic distance from it that I found very amusing, sort of the distance that I had from the place. We both recognized the ridiculousness of it. He was also not a fanatic. And I mean, he was an ardent nationalist, ardent Palestinian nationalist. Don't get me wrong. But he had some distance from it, and he could analyze politics, not just spout politics, if you will. And so it became very interesting to talk to him. Because, you know, one of the things about any army service is that, you know, it's generally speaking, stretches of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. And for long periods of time, it was quite nothing going on. And so we both found some sort of amusement, or something more than amusement, in these conversations we had, and it was the first Palestinian I got to know well.
Well, when you talked with him, was it a matter of each of you, in a sense, trying to understand something of the perspective of the other, or was there some attempt at persuasion where you were trying to persuade, one was trying to persuade the other of the rightness of their position?
Yes and yes. There was a lot of joking persuasion. I mean, he wasn't going to move me off my basic understanding of the conflict, and I wasn't going to move him. But he was curious about my understanding, and I was curious about his. In other words, you know, as you know, I'm sure what you have here, among other things, is dueling narratives. The 1948 war is called the catastrophe by Palestinians, and it's called the War of Liberation by Jews. So you have a different understandings of the same events, and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, the first step toward in any dialogue, any honest dialogue, is to actually elucidate. Is actually to sort of shed some light on what's different before you can get to what you have in common. You got to figure out what's separating you. So that in itself was incredibly interesting and useful. And I mean, in terms of convincing him of something or convincing me of something, you know, these kind of relationships don't change much in terms of politics, but I think they change something in terms of, I don't know, emotion is a cheap word, but emotion in the sense that, you know, oh, your enemy now has at least a face, you know, and he's not monochromatic anymore. He's not one dimensional. He's actually a person, and that's useful both from the perspective of knowledge, and it's useful also from the perspective of figuring out where you can agree, where you can agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to have a baseline of of mutual respect in order to go anywhere in a conversation like that.
Now, he is someone who clearly was very committed to his cause as he saw it and still sees it, I'm sure. And there was this sobering moment where you're having this conversation with him and you just say to him, well, you know, supposing that we're not here, supposing we're somewhere else, we're just walking down the street, and supposing, you know, the circumstances were such that you had to kill me, would you do it?
Right.
And, well, what did he say?
Well, I pushed him on that question, and finally he said, look, it wouldn't be personal. In other words, you know, he wouldn't necessarily want to do it, but there might be a need for it. I mean, it took me a while, by the way. I felt very bad after that conversation, quite obviously. But it took me a while to recognize that the same was true for me. I mean, there could be circumstances in which I, as an Israeli soldier, would have to shoot him. And in fact, it wouldn't be personal. It'd be the opposite of personal. I wouldn't want to do it, but that's the nature of the conflict, is that sometimes you have to do things, or you're forced to do things, or you believe that you have to do things that you don't want to do. That was, by the way, I almost think of that as the beginning of my Middle East education, because until then I had this very American notion again. I go back to that idea. This very American notion that the personal could trump the political. In other words, breaking bread with someone really means that you're now no longer enemies; you're friends. And this is that was a good lesson in understanding how hard it is.
Well, I think at that point, it's something that I think, you know, outside observers who don't have a stake, who have this naive kind of idea that somehow if it was possible for more people on the two sides of this divide to have that kind of relationship that you and he had, it, at the very least being able to sit down and have some kind of civil dialogue, maybe impassioned but still civil, and if more of that could happen, then that might go some way to having a more peaceful settlement. And
right.
I suppose on the one hand, you have to say, well, how many people are there who are even capable of having that dialogue? And then further, you ask the question, well, in fact, even if that could happen more than it does, what potential really does that, would that dialogue have? Would that indeed make any difference?
Well, I mean, this is, you're on to something very important. There are some people who overvalue dialogue. There are some people who undervalue dialogue. I try to keep it in perspective. And what I mean by that is that peace is ultimately going to be made on the political level. It's not going to be made on the personal level. But you can lay the groundwork for the reconciliation that needs to happen by having relationships that cross these lines. And also, I mean, there's this great phrase, you know, that there's nothing wrong with achieving disagreement. You know, we think that the end product of a dialogue has to be that you all agree on something, but it's not. I mean, what you can do is at least have an understanding of where you disagree. Then when you know what where the minefields are, you can avoid them. You could build bridges over them. You could do things. But I think you know, peace ultimately will come as a combination of the political and the personal. But it has to be done, you know, obviously it has to be done at the leadership level.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation.
Sure.
We do that. Someone who's listening in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just have a really fundamental question. What language did you use, or languages, to communicate with each other?
That's a very good question. One of the funny things about one of the indications of how close we all are in a kind of way is that obviously a lot of Israelis speak Arabic and even more Palestinians speak Hebrew. We spoke in the many of the prisoners had either worked in Israel, some had gone to school in Israel, and so they spoke quite good Hebrew. With some of the more educated people, I spoke English, and I have a little bit of Arabic, and we work that as well. So it was kind of this mix of languages.
Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. But after both of you were gone from this place, later, you meet him again, this time in Gaza.
Right. Right. We met again years later, and you know, this is the thing. I told some of these guys when I left the prison that one day I wanted to come find them, and you know, they thought that sounded crazy, and I thought it sounded crazy too. But we did it. I eventually went and did that, and you know, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but one of the hopes that I have about the future of the Middle East is that, well, let me step back and just talk about the politics for a minute. I mean, I think we're in a negative trend, obviously. The victory of Hamas, for instance, in the Palestinian elections is no good. That doesn't lead to peace. And one of the things that's happened in this conflict is that it's become more of a religious conflict. It used to be a political conflict between two nations, and it was essentially a real estate conflict. You have a piece of land that I want. That's negotiable. Lawyers can do that. But when it becomes a religious conflict, there's no hope for negotiation, because if, let's take Hamas, for example, if they believe that they're doing what God wants them to do, it's going to be very hard to convince them to make compromises. The same thing is true with the settlers on the West Bank, the Jewish settlers on the West Bank. You know, if you're there because God tells you to be there, it's not negotiable. So the trends are bad. The trends are all bad. And look, we see this obviously in Iraq. We see, you know, religion coming to the fore in that conflict. In Lebanon is being split across across religious lines. You know, where Iran's government is a theocracy that's motivated by its own vision of what Islam wants it to do. We're heading into a cataclysm here. That said, you know, it's not too late, at least in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for rational people on both sides to come together and build something. And the reason I feel like I can say that is that I've developed over these past years knowledge of this and personal relationships with people that have withstood some of the horrors of the conflict over the last 6 or 7 years. And by that I mean that some of the Palestinians who I know are as committed to the idea of a two-state solution in the Middle East as they have ever been. They're not in the majority right now in the government, the Palestinian government, but it's still not too late. But it's getting close to becoming too late. Yeah.
Well, how would you, let me ask you this, how would you react to the criticism of Israel that would say something like, it would have been a lot easier to settle this back at the point where it was a real estate conflict, and the fact that it now has become a religious conflict has to do with the failure of Israel to want to settle it, to bargain in good faith,
right,
to deal with some kind of fair division of the real estate, and that this could have been settled some time ago?
Well, I would say two things. One, the Israel came into possession of the West Bank and Gaza because the Arabs announced a plan to annihilate the country in 1967. Israel preempted their attack and won that war. That said, Israel for many years made mistakes by settling people on the land that it seized in 67. But to come back, in Israel's defense, Israel is a self-correcting democracy, and by the year 2000, certainly the work building on the groundwork of Yitzhak Rabin, the late Yitzhak Rabin, Ehud Barak did go to Camp David with a serious idea of ending the conflict. Yasser Arafat, according to Bill Clinton's memoirs and according to a lot of other people who were there, wasn't ready to bring an end to the conflict, and then the violence erupted again. You have a government in Israel right now that was elected on one platform only, which was to withdraw 80% of the settlers from the West Bank unilaterally as a starting point toward fixing this. So I would say that Israel has done quite a good job in the last several years of making it clear that it wanted to negotiate something, and that unfortunately the Palestinian leadership wasn't ready at that time. Now, Israel's already also made a mistake recently. When Arafat died, there was a great opportunity. When Yasser Arafat, the PLO leader, died, there was a great opportunity for Israel to restart negotiations with a new, more moderate Palestinian leadership. And the Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, didn't believe that Palestinians wanted to or were capable of negotiating this conflict. So he did not reach out at that moment when he could have. And so both sides are to blame. I think in recent years, though, you have to look at what happened at Camp David in 2000 as the greatest of the missed opportunities. It doesn't mean that other people haven't missed other opportunities, but it's the greatest of the missed opportunities in recent years.
There's still, you know, and I think I've talked about this probably with a lot of other people. I think back to a moment before the Second Intifada began when I remembered reading stories about a meeting between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat. And
right.
I think that it was actually at Barak's house, something like that. And I remember reading these stories about how both men had this wonderful, said it was the most wonderful meeting they'd ever had. It was great. There was this real feeling of optimism, the possibility that there could be progress. And then it seemed like things turned sour in about 5 minutes. And I guess I've never really been able to understand what happened and in what sense that maybe had something to do with Israel and Palestinians, but also had something to do with internal Israeli politics when also
which
things
moment is
to
this
right.
again?
Well, it would have been after Camp David, during the Clinton administration,
mm-hmm.
before the Second Intifada started, when it looked like there actually was this
oh, yeah, no, that's
opportunity.
An, yeah, no, well, there was greater and greater opportunities all the way running into December of 2000. Mm-hmm. The problem again is an extension of the same problem. I mean, there's a wonderful passage in Clinton's memoirs. I've actually read the whole thing. Should get a prize for it, but it's a good book actually. There's a wonderful passage in which Clinton says, sort of aghast, you know, he says, "I can't believe that Yasser Arafat is going to blow this." And that was about December, and there's this wonderful moment when Arafat was a kind of a sycophantic sort of guy, and he called up Bill Clinton after rejecting Clinton's latest proposal. He called him up and said, "Mr. President, you'll be remembered as a great president." This is obviously after the election. Clinton has a month more in office, and Bill Clinton says, and I'm paraphrasing, it's in the book, he says, "No, I'm not a great president, and you're the reason that I'm not a great president, because you caused me to lose this fight for Middle East peace." There you are. Obviously there's differing views. There are a lot of people who want to blame the Israelis and the Americans more than the Palestinians, but I don't know. Clinton's accounting of it is pretty definitive to me.
Well, on that other side, then I guess the thing that people keep saying is that the great offer was that it actually wasn't such a great offer, that there was no way that this could have been a viable state, and that Arafat couldn't have
accepted. I disagree.
Accepted.
I mean, by December 2000, and you look at the documents, December 2000, the offer was for 100% of Gaza, 97% of the West Bank, a land swap between Israel and the Palestinians, so that they would have contiguous, the Palestinians would get contiguous land attached to the West Bank. Israel would give up territory in order to make it 100%. The Palestinian capital would be in East Jerusalem. There would be contiguity between the northern West Bank and the southern West Bank. It was, you know, it was what it was. I mean, there's, you know, people say this and people say that, but I mean, if you talk to most of the people who were at Camp David, including, by the way, some of the people who were around Arafat, you see, one of the things that people don't remember is that there was a huge division in the Palestinian delegation. There were people, let's say, call them the realists or the pragmatists, who wanted Arafat to pull the trigger, who wanted Arafat to make the deal. Which I'm bringing that back now to the Sharon point, which was those people came to the fore when Arafat died, and they had their moment, and Israel could have capitalized on their rise. But of course, Ariel Sharon was a very different kind of prime minister than Ehud Barak. So I mean, I just disagree with that. I don't see any proof that that's true. Clinton has the maps. You know, he'll show you.
Yeah.
You know.
So then, what is your take on why it is that Yasser Arafat turned down the deal?
Because he wasn't capable of making peace. He didn't want to bring it. The important thing for him, he was a revolutionary. He wasn't a leader of a small Arab state. He wanted everything. He was mystically attached to the whole of Palestine, and he couldn't bring himself to bring an end to the conflict. And this is a trend, obviously. I mean, if you look at Palestinian history, in 1948, the UN came to the Arabs and the Jews in Palestine and offered a partition plan. I think the Arabs got 52% of the land and the Jews got 48% of the land. The Jews accepted the partition and the Arabs rejected it and attacked the Jews. And the Jews happened to win that war. That was the War of Independence, or the catastrophe, as the Palestinians call it. And that trend has continued. I mean, Yasser Arafat has been the least successful liberation leader in the last 50 years. I mean, you know, Fatah, his organization that formed the core of the PLO, was founded 42 years ago, and they haven't done anything for the Palestinians. They haven't gotten them anywhere. There's another side to this that says this is actually a smart strategy, that another 20, 30, 40, 50 years of this conflict will wear down Israel to the point where it will cease to exist, and that ultimately the Palestinians will win back the whole of Palestine. It might take 150 years, but there's that idea. But again, like I said, there's different trend lines in the Palestinian community. There are pragmatists who actually look to the lesson of 1948, and the lesson that they see in 1948 was that the Jews in Palestine took the imperfect offer that the UN was offering because they thought it was better than nothing. And there are a lot of Palestinians still today, including these people who were around Arafat, who say, you know what, let's take what we can get, and then we can hope for better. You know, maybe something will happen. It doesn't mean that they're going to become pro-Israel. It means that they have their hope that something will happen, but at least let's get a foothold. At least let's get this state going on the West Bank and Gaza.
I mean, I've got a caller here I want to get to. Let me just ask you one other question, because I think that one of the things that I think that a lot of people have difficulty understanding is why it is that the Palestinians would persist in an armed struggle when it seems pretty clear that it's one that they can't win.
They can win. I mean, if you persist long enough and hard enough, you can make Israel an unlivable place. That's the theory. That's the theory of the radicals. You know, it's not the theory of all the Palestinians. But that, you know, you don't actually have to kill every Israeli you don't have to send a suicide bomber to kill every Israeli to make the place unlivable. You can over generations convince the Israelis, who are a Western-oriented people, that, you know what, it's not worth living here in the Middle East, and you can drive them away. I think terrorism can work. In fact, I'm not happy about saying that, but I think the armed struggle is not quite as crazy as it seems. I think it's immoral to target civilians, but I think that's the long strategy, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's a long strategy there. Of course, I mean, I argue in the book that nonviolence would have gotten them a state faster than violence. If you used Gandhian mass civil disobedience tactics against a Western democracy like Israel, the Western democracy would have collapsed before the moral power of the nonviolent civil disobedience. But that's a whole other subject about why you don't see nonviolence in the Middle East as a political tactic.
Well, why? That's something that seems to people do raise that point now and again. Why is it that you don't see that as a tactic?
I've asked that question, you know, even when I was in the prison. Because listen, I come out of a liberal, you know, left background. Parents were involved in the civil rights movement, and so that's my paradigm for understanding how you should deal with injustice. And I said, why don't you just, you know, 10,000 Palestinians march onto a road and have a sit-in and block the entrance to a settlement, say. And they say, well, the Israelis will come and beat us. And I say, yeah, that happened with Gandhi and the Salt March with the British. But eventually the British had to stop beating because the moral power of the nonviolent protest overwhelmed them. And the answer that I would inevitably get is, hey, you were Arab men. We're not going to let ourselves get beaten in the head by Jews. And also, let's deal with, I mean, you have to deal with religions and ideas as they are. Islam is a militant religion in some ways, and it was spread in part by the sword. Muhammad is a very different figure as a leader of religion than, say, Jesus. You know, the line is that, you know, Muhammad was his own Constantine. Jesus went passively to his death, which is something that Muslims don't understand, because Muhammad was a warrior. He was a general. And so you don't find, you don't find nonviolence or passivity as a sacred value in Islamic holy texts. And so... goodness knows. I mean, I'm sure there's a dozen reasons why it doesn't work, but there have been people who've tried to work on that, but it never gains traction.
Our guest is Jeffrey Goldberg. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He was for 10 years a Middle East correspondent, both for The New Yorker and for The New York Times Magazine. He's winner of the National Magazine Award for his reporting on Hezbollah. And he is the author of a memoir that was published last fall. I'm sure you can find it if you'd like to read it. It's titled Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. It's published by Knopf, and it is in part an account of his relationship over now like more than 15 years with a man that he first met when this man was being held in a prison camp in Israel. And our guest, Jeffrey Goldberg, was at the time in the Israeli Defense Forces and had been assigned as a guard. Questions are welcome. Just please keep in mind that we're now moving into our last 15 minutes, and it will really help us if callers are brief. We have at least two here ready to go, and we'll start with Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes.
Your guest's last comment verges on racism, but worse, it seems to me, was his earlier account of the Camp David negotiations, which is simply nonsense. I mean, basically Israeli propaganda. In fact, those negotiations were continued at Taba and broken off only by the Israelis when it looked like they might get someplace. Shlomo Ben Ami, who was Israeli foreign minister, has said quite clearly that the offer, the so-called generous offer turned down by Arafat, is something that that no one could accept. Even he says that, and it seems to me that a clear account of what went on there would be a big help instead of this this propagandistic one.
Well, Mr. Goldberg, you want to respond?
Well, I generally believe the Bill Clinton line, and I don't think Bill Clinton is an Israeli propagandist. I talked to the Palestinians as well, and like I said, Mohammed Dahlan, many of these people who were there wanted to take the deal, and Arafat didn't let them, but, you know, this gentleman has his opinion. In terms of the more serious charge, racism, I'm reporting to you what Muslims tell me. I've spent years trying to convince Palestinians that nonviolence might actually get them a state faster than violence. And other people have as well. And it doesn't seem to gain traction. And when I ask why it doesn't seem to gain traction, these are some of the answers that I get. I don't think it's racist to say that Muhammad was a general. If that's a racist thing to say, then I guess the Quran is racist. But that's the way the Quran portrays him, as fighting in 100 battles. So that martial quality is valued in that faith. And there is machismo in the Middle East. I don't think that's any great surprise to anyone that it's hard for some people in the Middle East to think that that the behavior associated with nonviolence, which is passive resistance, is not very macho. I mean, we as Americans and people who admire the bravery of the Freedom Riders or the people who sat in at lunch counters at Woolworths and who were, you know, violently attacked and withstood it, we think of them as very macho and brave, but that doesn't translate necessarily into different cultures.
The Camp David offer would have left the Palestinians with a series of Bantustans, barely connected, but it wasn't quite so generous as what white South Africa offered the blacks under apartheid, because at least white South Africa funded the Bantustans. Israel was not even interested in doing that.
Have you read Bill Clinton's account of the Camp David negotiations?
Have you read the accounts of the...
I've read every account. I've read every single account. Yes, sir.
Kaba, and yes, pointed out that the reservations from both sides were being discussed and worked out there.
Yes, sir, I have. And like I said, there's differing views, and I think that I'm going to go with the view that the president who was leading negotiations took.
Amount of truth, it seems to me that to quote his account against the others, such as the Israeli foreign minister, is a mistake.
Well, that's fine. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree.
All right, well, let's go on to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number four. Hello.
Hi. As far as nonviolence is used a lot in the West Bank. We only hear about it when it's like Rachel Corrie standing up against a Caterpillar tractor and getting run over. But we actually hear about it. There's quite a few Israelis that you could interview and write about if you wanted to, who'd talk about the opposition to I'm thinking of the fellow Albert who's leading the opposition to home demolition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of that going on all the time, and you just don't want to look at it because it doesn't suit your purposes to reduce it to some kind of religious battle. As far as making it...
I can't understand the caller. I'm sorry. I'm not hearing it very well.
Carl, we're actually having some trouble because your line is really distorted.
On the pay phone here. That might help a little bit.
That's better.
Okay. The point I was making is that there is a lot of attempts at nonviolence going on all the time in the West Bank, and some Israelis even collaborated with the home demolition opposition led by, I believe it's a Daniel Alpert, I forget his name, who's probably born down the block from you in Long Island. I'm not sure about that. And I apologize, but I'm just very furious with this strategy. As far as making it a religious battle, I think you had a lot to do with that in your New Yorker articles. And as far as corresponding with prisoners, the relying on a single-source prisoner who told you what he wanted to hear when you were making the link between al-Qaeda in Iraq in the pages of the New Yorker, I don't think that was the particular issue that Cheney was waving around in Meet the Press, but you are... You have to account for a lot, and I realize you're trying to sell a book, but there's a lot of history here that you are covering over, manipulating, and you're not taking any responsibility for your own role in making the Middle East a cauldron.
I don't really know what the caller is talking about, and I'm sorry, he sounds very furious, but I don't really know what he's referring to, so maybe there's another question in there or something.
Well, I'm not sure that there's going to be any meeting of the minds here between you and these two particular callers.
No, I guess not.
We do have about 5-6 minutes left. If somebody else wants to call, you certainly can do that. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. By the way, our guest is Jeffrey Goldberg. He's a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, and also for 10 years was a Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker and for The New York Times magazine.
Right. You know, it's interesting, the fury in these calls, it's interesting that I'm somebody who stood against the settlement movement and written very clearly about it. I know this person. I don't know what he's referring to or how Dick Cheney somehow worked his way into that conversation. But that's my record on that is very clear. I do think that the solution to the Middle East crisis, a solution, is a Palestinian state on all of the West Bank and Gaza, capital in East Jerusalem. I believe that's the only hope for both the Palestinians and the Israelis. These are moderate positions, I think. It's the position of moderate-seeming people. It's even Jimmy Carter's position if you get to the end of his book. That's where he comes out. And I don't understand sometimes the fury that people feel toward Jews or Israelis who defend Israel. It's almost as if there's a deep-seated need to blame Jews for, blame Israel for all the crises of the Middle East. I'm not sure where that tremendous fury comes from.
Well, because the caller mentioned it, and I was not aware of it, did you, in fact, write a piece for The New Yorker suggesting there were links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein?
I wrote extensive pieces from Kurdistan and Iraq, and I reported on before the war on a particular al-Qaeda-related group called Ansar al-Islam in the northernmost Iraq. I did not make a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. I suggested that I interviewed a number of people, one of whom, you know, it's very funny. I did some reporting in which one person made an allegation that there was a connection and one person denied it. It's called reporting. And I don't know why this has become some sort of red flag for this person who called in, but I'm a little bit surprised at it because it was a very long story, and it was about two paragraphs of one particular story. It was very odd.
Well, we have about 5 minutes. We have a couple of callers. We'll see if we can get them both next champagne in line one. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank your guest for his indulgence at these outbursts, and I want to assure him that, in fact, the opinions in Champaign-Urbana are not really being represented by the two individuals who called in. But I have a very simple question. I'd like to go back to your relationship with this young man, or this Palestinian, that you write the book about. And that is, I'd like to know, first of all, what was that person's background? Where was he born and so on? And did you exchange with him information about your background? Did you have to explain to him why you, as an American from Long Island, suddenly found yourself in a prison camp and so on and so forth?
Well, he was very curious about that and dubious about it, and so I explained it to him. Look, one of the goals that I have is to have Israelis try to understand Palestinians and Palestinians try to understand Israelis. Like I said at the beginning, you know, you're not going to get anywhere in terms of peace unless you at least understand. You don't have to accept the morality of it or the rightness of it, but you have to understand where that other person is coming from, why his narrative has value to him. This person in question is from a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, the Jabalia refugee camp, pretty nasty place.
Was he born there?
He was born in the refugee camp. Yeah, his father was a refugee from an area in southern, what's now southern Israel, and he was born there. And he was academically very gifted, and so he always seemed, smarter than the average person, either on the Israeli or Palestinian side. I didn't know all that much about him when I was there, but it turns out he was the number one math student in Gaza the year before he was arrested for activities as part of the PLO. And so he went on after the prison to an academic career. But he, it's funny because, I always said to him, sometimes I said when I was growing up, I felt like a refugee or I felt like an alien in my own country. I don't feel that way anymore in America, but that's the way I felt when I was growing up. And he, he would sort of look at me and scoff and say, hey, you want to know how it feels to be a refugee? My psychic displacement to him was not very interesting compared to the actual displacement of his family.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll go to Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Now that Muslims are threatening not just Israel, but they're threatening Western civilization, and they have expressed their threat with appalling moral depravity, couldn't the Western world ostracize them on the basis that if they want to live in the Western world, if they want to be partners with us, all right. But right now they don't deserve even to be there. The kind of moral depravity that they have exhibited, that they can't be part of civilized.
Well,
could you approach them that way?
Well, I'm amazed at the extremity of views in the Champaign, Urbana, Bloomington area. I don't agree with the premise of what you're saying. There are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, and they probably have 1.3 billion different opinions about the way they should interact with the world. There's a faction of Islam that's very violent right now, and we can't deny that. But the real war, and this is what people miss sometimes. The real war is not between the West and Islam. It's inside Islam, and you have some people who have a particular understanding of Islam that's very violent, and the more serious Islamic scholars say that it's a perversion of Islam, what's basically a moderate religion, and the war is going on inside that. I don't think ostracizing people is going to do anything. One of the amazing things is how many Muslim Americans joined the army after 9/11. It's quite, in quite large numbers. So it's interesting because these calls are very interesting. They have this sort of hyper simplistic understanding that one party has to be extremely wrong and the other party has to be extremely right. And this is a very gray area sometimes. Obviously, terrorism is terrorism, and you have to combat it. But this is much more complex and complicated than people, or at least some of these callers, seem to believe it is.
Well, in about a minute, coming back to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, can you talk about whether you are you at all optimistic for some sort of movement anytime within the next 50 to 100 years?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, look, this is a human. These are human endeavors here. Humans change. And one of the only constants in the Middle East is sudden and dramatic change. Consider where I was in 1990 in this prison. By 1993, Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin were shaking hands on the White House lawn. So things can happen quickly. And you know, one of the let's say few benefits right now of what's going on in the Middle East is that in all of the turmoil, much of it created inadvertently by America, in all the turmoil, there's a chance that something better could emerge out of this prolonged instability, generally speaking and specifically in the Palestinian-Israeli arena. I don't think it's happening tomorrow, but I'm not without hope for peace.
Well, at that point, I think that we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. For people who would like to read more of the book that we mentioned, I'll give you the title once again, the memoir that our guest Jeff Goldberg wrote. It's titled Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. It's published by Knopf. It came out last fall. I'm sure you can find it in a bookstore or the library. Our guest Jeffrey Goldberg is Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Also before that, worked as a Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker and also for The New York Times Magazine. Mr. Goldberg, thanks very much.
Thank you.